I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. As that old Captain and Tennille song says, love will keep us together. But today on Smart City, we'll find out how love can also be a primary economic driver for cities. My guest, Larry Beasley, is the founder of Beasley & Associates, an international planning consultancy. And Larry will tell us about planning cities based around an emotional response. And we'll find out how to make the world a better place with Jonathan Greenblatt. He runs the organization allforgood.org, and he'll tell us about the new venture, which he describes as a Craigslist for social good. All that, plus the latest from Planetizen and our City News commentator Walker Smith, coming up on today's Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. My first guest, Larry Beasley, is one of the world's top urban planners. As the former director of planning, he helped establish the city of Vancouver as one of the most livable cities in the world. Lately, though, Larry has been advocating the idea that love is the primary force in the economy of the city, that people will only come to a city and stay there if they feel true affection for the place. So I ask Larry, how do we make lovable cities?
Well, you know, for well over, I'd say, certainly since the war, mid-century, last century, we have been looking at cities as machines. We've been looking at them as efficiencies, as systems, and we've been forgetting about people's emotions. We've been forgetting about how people experience the city on a day-to-day, moment-to-moment basis, and how fulfilling it is for them, for their children, for their loved ones, and their friends. And it's leading to cities that people don't like. We have a widespread difficulty in North America in particular of people not really liking their cities, fleeing to the suburbs, not really investing in the city, being afraid in the city, not feeling good. And I believe, that if we tap back into people's emotions, to the things that they wish they were experiencing the city, and if we can make those experiences happen, then, in fact, people will vest their care, their love, their attention, and with that, their wealth, their energy, and their expertise back into the city, and that will feed the economy.
So what do cities have to do then to become well-liked? How do cities serve those human needs and emotions?
We have to go back to designing our cities at the level of the human being. We have to think specifically what kind of experiences human beings want. I call it experiential planning. Removing, dealing with all the systematic aspects, the infrastructure aspects, but removing that as the prime focus and going back to a simple set of questions of what is it you want your city to be? How do you want your city to come together? What experiences do you want? What will make you happy in your city? And then creating those things. And that's not hard to do. Certainly, the last generation or two, there has not been a lot of attention to the physical design of the city other than the systems for its streets and the systems for its utilities and the zoning for its buildings, but not really thinking about those more experiential things. We should be thinking about smell. We should be thinking about sound. We should be thinking about safety and security, not in a militaristic way, but in a much more encompassing, gentle way. We should be thinking about color. We should be back to talking about beauty and art and all of those aspects of the city. We should be thinking about the management of light and shadow to keep people's temperatures where they want their temperatures to be. We have research now that tells us that people shy away from places when they get physically uncomfortable in those places. All of that has to come back, not just into casual thinking, but rather into the actual policy of the cities and then into implementation. And it's really just coming back to the design of our cities.
It suggests a different level of skill on the part of planners.
Oh, yes, it's absolutely a different focus. The profession of planning, and I've been practicing this profession for 35 years, has not really been focusing on the physical design of the city. And neither have architects. Architects have been talking about the design of individual buildings, but it's the public environment that glues everything together. And it is out in the public realm that people, you know, really want to have those wonderful positive experiences, not just when they go into a particular complex. And that's where the focus has to come back. Cities have to reestablish a design dialogue in each city about what makes that city special, what makes it unique. The work I'm just starting to do in Dallas, where they are forming, in an incredibly forward-looking move, an urban design center for the city to help facilitate education and interest of their people in the physical design of the public realm of their city. A very wonderful move. Or take the initiatives of Mayor Daley in Chicago with the new Millennium Park and the wonderful art installations and his attention to the landscape of the great parkways of Chicago. These are the kind of things that have to happen in every city, and they have to be pervasive, not just occasionally. They have to be the sum total of people's moment-to-moment experience.
It sounds like such an overwhelming task getting from here to there. How do you get from where we are today to where you think we need to be in terms of planning and making cities that people love?
Well, you know, on the one hand, it is an overwhelming task. For one thing, we are facing a series of standards that were not designed for people's care and comfort and energy and interest, but more for the efficiency of the city. There are building codes. There are inappropriate street standards. There are parking requirements. There are safety and security standards, all of which are brutalizing people. And we have to prevail over those things. But, you know, having said that, it's as easy as convening in your city a discussion about the design of your city and starting with one street, starting with one square or one place in your city and starting to make it something better. What we have found is that the good design of cities, good design of the public realm, is a very profitable venture for those who have private property in the vicinity. Here in Vancouver, where we've put a lot of attention to the public realm, we've developed a lavish park and waterfront walkway system in our inner city. The land values all around have gone up. The tax results of that have been more than enough to pay for the ongoing maintenance obligations that come with a city embellished with art and landscape and flowers and, you know, and water and all those other features that make a city wonderful.
You talk about starting with one street, and yet it feels to me as if cities reach a tipping point, reach a point where there's enough critical mass of those wonderful single streets that you then begin to attract more of what is good, whether it's talent, whether it's design, beauty, art, people on the street. Have you thought about that tipping point and where it lies in terms of cities that are loved and cities that aren't?
Yes, in fact, you're absolutely right. In a sense, we have to think in a broader sense and develop policy and initiatives in a broader sense, but we have to act in a local focused way. If, for example, in your community, you can start seeing community-based initiatives that begin to address the difficult issues in that community, and you can have many of those going at once, and it's not a terribly expensive thing to do. If at the same time you have your urban designers in your city who are looking at the key public places and beginning to think of those from a positive design and an experiential point of view, and if you begin to adjust your development management system for private development to emphasize not just what's going on, you know, for the utility of the building, but how that building relates to the public environment around it, how it offers the comforts and securities and supports that people need for a positive experience, then you begin to see things happening in all the different fronts. And yes, at some point, there is a tipping point. What occurs is that you shift the attitude first of your people shifts, because they begin to have positive experience and they enjoy it and they talk about it. And then the image of your city shifts with the general public knowledge that these things have been going on. I saw it here in my city. In the late 60s, early 70s, my city was a very typical North American city. It was losing population in the inner city. It was beginning to see the difficulties of destabilization, depopulation. And we turned it around. We turned it around with a coherent plan, and we turned it around with a series of initiatives on those many fronts that I just talked about, to a point that people now identify the city as very livable. It gets awards for its livability. I just completed a survey of about 15,000 people in one of our newer neighborhoods in the inner city, and we found a 90% level of very profound happiness about living in this community, because it has lavish parks, it has community facilities, it has childcare, it has accommodations. The environment was designed for children. You know, even the landscape was selected so that there wouldn't be poisonous landscapes, so that children could play freely and not be at risk. And this gets around. And then your city starts to differentiate itself from those cities that aren't doing it. I think in the future there are going to be alpha cities and there are going to be delta cities. The alpha cities are going to be the great, wonderful, livable places, and they're going to draw all the wealth and energy, because capital is footloose. People are footloose in a way they've never been before in the history of the world. And then the delta cities are going to be just producing the goods.
I see the same trend, and it's scary.
It is.
And I think you're absolutely right. This is what's happening. And I'm not sure urban leaders have quite come to grips with how stark the difference will be between these two options.
Yes, I think you're right. And the fact is that what Sir Peter Hall of Great Britain calls the service city, or the cities that are literally a lot of their economies are driven by service industries as compared to manufacturing and big government and other things like that. And in combination with the cities that are becoming more ideas-based in their economies, these kinds of cities are beginning to really push the frontier on this. And we're beginning to see what occurs. We are beginning to see a strong migration towards these cities, and then you're left with other cities just struggling. Now, what occurs with many urban leaders is they're still focused just on the direct economic questions. They're thinking to themselves, how do I get a mix of this kind of activity and that kind of activity? You know, the old economic development questions. And this issue of the aesthetics, the beauty, the livability of your city is seen by many people as, oh, you know, that's just icing on the cake, when ironically, it is the fundamental driver for these future cities. You know, Richard Florida of Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon, was the first probably to identify it. He talked about the creative class being drawn to these kind of cities. But, you know, it's not just that. It's all kinds of people. I mean, I don't know if you've tried to get a plumber in a great city. Well, those people are just as footloose as the creative class. They have children, they have families, they have lifestyle aspirations. They can do their job anywhere, literally anywhere, and they're making those choices.
And in order to have vibrant cities, the kinds of cities people love, what should be the relationship between cities and suburbs?
Well, in the cities of the future, and you begin to see this in the great urban patterning of, say, European cities, there will be multi-core cities or multi-centered cities. In those cities, not just in the old core, the center of Boston or Philadelphia or Chicago, but in certain locations throughout, in a pattern, people are going to be looking for higher order services and goods, but more importantly, they're going to be looking for higher order experience. They're going to be wanting to go to a place where they can sit outside, watch the world go by, gossip. They can buy luxury goods, but they can also get the basics they need. But even if they're not spending money, they can go and have a joyful experience. You know, the best city to visit is a city people love to live in, because you go there not for the attractions, not for the shopping, not for the money you're going to spend. You go for that wonderful experience that those people who live in that city are having on a day-to-day basis. That will not just happen in core cities in the future. Very smart suburbs are beginning to conceptualize their own cores, their own centers. They're trying to move beyond the auto dominance of particularly North American suburbs. They're trying to build those pedestrian places. We know, for example, that people long for the experiences of face-to-face contact that is a positive contact that occurs in the more walkable cities and the more walkable centers within cities. That's really what has to occur. We are never going to turn back the suburbanization process that's occurring in North American cities. Our job is to transform those suburban places into complete, full, fulfilling environments. That's really one of the biggest tasks as we move forward.
But let me ask you this, Larry, in terms of that relationship between cities and suburbs. It seems what has happened in many cities, particularly those that are not growing or maybe even shrinking, that what we've done is move people around so that no place can be quite vibrant, because no place has the density or the number of people needed to be vibrant. So is there some rule of thumb that you use to say, all right, if you want to support a multi-core cities, then, you know, each core needs this sort of density, this number of people to make it, in fact, a core, make it vibrant?
We have been working from a premise that the community scale at which you can begin to deliver the first order of community amenities and facilities and services is about 10,000 people within about a 5 to 7 minute walk across an area. When you want to go into the higher order, 10 to 25,000 people, you begin to be able to generate the kinds of amenities and that people need. Now, you have to realize that we have some things working in our favor here. And one of the most important things is demographics itself. We have an aging population on the one hand, and many of those people are retiring earlier. They're the front edge of the baby boomers, and they want their freedom. They want to have those experiences. They've learned through life that life is about experience, and they're going after that. Many people are trying to actually cash out of their homes. It's one of the problems that we have in the single-family economy throughout North America, is that there is now more and more people that want to cash out of those big homes, buy a place that might be multiple family or townhouses at least in a course area where they can begin to have those other experiences. And in fact, they're longing for better health even by being able to walk around. And we also have younger people that are coupling later in life. They're having their children later than they've ever done before. And those people are the second natural drivers. We also have a lot of people in alternative relationships more than ever before, and those people are also natural consumers for the kind of cities, the kind of places that we're talking about. Here in Vancouver, where we made it a public policy to also design these higher density places to be suitable for families with children, we've also seen just an explosion of even families with children, the one group you would think would be the hardest to draw back to the more dense, diverse, mixed-use communities that have to occur in order to get the livability and the walkability that I've been describing. So all of these factors are working together. They are potentially, they can be tapped into by a smart city. But a lot of this comes down to the smartness of that local government to understand that times have changed, conditions are changed, to look carefully at demand. We always tend to look at supply, the supply side of the equation. No, people have to start looking at the demand side. And when they start to do that, not just as people selling things, but as people like ourselves who are developing public policy to build a different kind of city, we will start to build a different kind of city, because people will tell you in no uncertain terms the kind of city that they really want.
You've said the city must build the city. The city must be an agent.
Yes.
What does it mean for the city to be an agent?
I have been saying for 30 years that the design and the unfolding of the city needs to be in the hands of a government that can represent all the interests of the city, that can go beyond special interests. I do not believe, even though I'm the vice president of a development company, is one of my jobs, I do not believe that the city should be simply built by the development community. I do not believe the city should simply be built by certain special interest or influential interest in a city. I believe the city is the agent that can draw all kinds of people together in a disinterested way with regard to the particular interests of those people and have a larger interest. Secondly, a city can generate a vision that will be powerful and engaging and will draw people to do their part differently than they would do when there's kind of confusion. So cities as local government entities are probably the best positioned of any governments that exist in order to do this because they are so close to the electorate, they're so close to the public, and there's such an intimate relationship between the governed and the governing. And this creates the possibility. But a city has to understand this. It has to rise to this occasion. It has to realize that its own competitive edge is no longer going to occur by having, you know, IBM or General Electric based in your town. It's going to be a competitive edge by having the ambience of San Francisco or, you know, the great cities that we all love and admire. Those few cities that have maintained that extraordinary ambience are very, very lucky, but we can create it. When I was a young planner, I used to say to myself, why can't we do row houses the way that they did them in London in the 18th century? I mean, my goodness, we have more education, more wealth, more of everything. And I discovered that, well, you can if you just decide to do it. And that's the same with squares and public places and public amenities and childcare and community facilities and celebrations and all the things that come for the greatness of a city.
What is the biggest opportunity going unrealized in cities today?
The biggest opportunity, in my opinion, is that cities control an extraordinary amount of the physical landmass of that city. When you really think that the cities control the streets, they control public spaces, they control many, many facilities, they control the park system, and if they decide to really shepherd that resource, they can, in fact, transform it. And it doesn't have to be an expensive thing. In Curitiba, the great urbanist Jaime Lerner decided that one of the ways to bring economic interest back to a street was to close that street to traffic. So what he did one night is he simply laid out paper for four blocks with a lot of crayons and colors, and he invited thousands of children to come and color the next morning. And in doing that, he banned the cars, and all of their parents came with them, and the transformation happened. I'm sort of simplifying for effect here, but my point is that we control so much of the land of a community as a city. And if we decide to take advantage of that, then even without great wealth, even without great budgets, we can start to do quite amazing things. And secondly, a city or a government, if it chooses to be, can be a great choreographer of all the diverse, fascinating interests of the city. This is, I think, where Mayor Daley has shown leadership that's been, I think, quite laudable. He's been a choreographer. He's brought a lot of people's energy and activities together into something that is bigger than their own interests. And when you take that choreography and you add it to the landmass, and then you add one final thing, which is a city can actually talk about an overall vision for their place, then you begin to have a powerful force to make real change on the ground.
One more question. Larry, you urge people to be brave in their own cities. What does that mean to you?
Well, it means to step beyond the limitations that seem to be articulated by such powerful forces. Let me take one simple example. The street design standards that were generated right after the Second World War at a time when somehow we thought the car was going to be the savior of mankind, that has really taken probably two-thirds of the public environment of the city and dedicated it to one simple activity, which is moving around by car. To just say in your city, we're not doing that. We're not going that way. Here in Vancouver, when they were developing the new Athletes Village for the Olympics, which will be a new community for about 17,000 people, the council one day said, we're going to narrow the streets by 10%. They didn't do traffic studies. They didn't call in and get the advice of their engineers. They just believed in the vision of people like Jane Jacobs and others who've said for years, if you just narrow the streets, you will calm the streets. And they've done it. That, to me, is courageous. It's courageous to step beyond the safety and the security of those kind of old standards and to do something different and new. It's also courageous to step beyond what appear to be the urgencies of the moment in budgets. You know, Dallas is just telling me they're struggling with their budgets under the economic conditions that face North America at the moment. And in the face of that, to still say, our future rests by investment in the quality of our life and the quality of our city. We're not just going to put all the money elsewhere. That's a courageous move. And thirdly, it is courageous to stand up in any community in North America as a politician, as a planner, as a designer, an urban designer, and to start talking about something else. You know, when you start to do that, first people are cynical, they roll their eyes, they have all the yes buts, as my grandmother used to say. But the fact is, to stand up and begin to dream again about our cities, that's a courageous move, in my opinion. But when that starts to happen, when we start to make those changes, I can tell you beyond a shadow of a doubt, I believe this deeply and profoundly, that you will begin to see a reaction of the public that will be a level of joy that we haven't enjoyed in cities for many, many years. And that will be followed up with people investing their money, investing their energy, investing their expertise, and growing their love for the city. And with that love comes a kind of a strength that will allow that city to be robust against many, many of the economic ebbs and flows that we see and that we're experiencing right now.
Larry, it is always a special pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you. It's been a great joy for me, too.
Larry Beasley is formerly the Director of Urban Planning for the City of Vancouver and is now the Distinguished Practice Professor of Planning at the University of British Columbia, as well as the founding principal of Beasley & Associates, an international planning consultancy. There's an extended version of my interview with Larry on our website, smartcityradio.com. And now for the latest in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
Four years after it was devastated by Hurricane Katrina, the city of New Orleans is still climbing back. But things are steadily improving. A recent article from the New York Times looked at the city's recovery and notes that the population is back to nearly 75% of pre-Katrina levels, and homes are slowly being rebuilt. But increasingly, the sentiment in the city is not about rebuilding the old New Orleans. In fact, many people are calling for a sharp detour from the city of the past, where unemployment was rampant and the economy was dragging. Already, entrepreneurs and small businesses are flocking to the city, which many see as a blank slate. And with tens of billions of government dollars coming to the city over the next few years, this infusion offers what some say is a golden chance to rebrand the city as a place for new businesses to thrive. Essentially, they hope it's a chance to create a new New Orleans. Meanwhile, in South Africa, the booming metropolis of Johannesburg has just begun operations on the nation's first bus rapid transit system. It's the biggest public transportation project undertaken by the country in years, and Johannesburg's BRT is just the first in a nationwide program. According to an article from the AFP, the new dedicated lane bus rapid transit system will connect outlying areas to the center of the city, and also to the new soccer stadium being built for South Africa's hosting duties of the 2010 Soccer World Cup. The system represents a big step forward for the country, which had previously depended on minibuses and private taxis for inner-city transportation. The new system is part of a push towards broader municipal transit services in the country, many of which are being fast-tracked for completion in time for next summer's World Cup. And finally, in New York, a series of recent studies has tracked the economic benefits of parks within the city. The Gotham Gazette offers a summary, which estimates that the new Highline Linear Park will bring about nearly $4 billion worth of real estate investments to the area, and that Central Park contributes about $1 billion to the local economy per year. A variety of other reports from across the country back up these claims that parks have a positive impact on the economy. But in tough times, parks budgets are facing reductions all over the U.S. Without the money to keep up parks and their programs, many worry their economic power will also dissipate. Advocates say that without healthy parks, it will be harder to return to a healthy economy. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen.com. Coming up in the second half of our show, we'll speak with Jonathan Greenblatt. He'll tell us his strategy for making the world a better place. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. You could call my next guest a serial social entrepreneur. Jonathan Greenblatt is the founder of Ethos Water and a regular contributor to the website worldchanging.com. His latest project is another big idea, a website called allforgood.org. Jonathan, describe All for Good.
All for Good is an open source, web-based application that was inspired by President Obama and enables more Americans to serve.
Now tell me more about United We Serve. I think that was a call by President Obama for us to volunteer for 81 days. Tell me about that and then how All for Good relates to that.
Sure. Even as a presidential candidate, Barack Obama really focused on national service and really created on a campaign of many priorities. Service is one of his top issues. And he really integrated a strategy on how more Americans get involved in strengthening their communities and supporting the national recovery through service. I had the privilege of serving on the presidential transition along with many other people, and this issue of national service went from a campaign priority to a priority in terms of governance. So we thought about how could we create policies and programs that would encourage service. So as president-elect, he laid out a very clear plan to triple the AmeriCorps, to double the Peace Corps, to inject more funding into the Corporation for National Service, to create a social innovation fund, to help scale up successful nonprofit models across the country and really find what works. So a broad agenda. But specifically, we also thought about how could we construct public-private partnerships that would, again, engage more Americans to service and also utilize the remarkable talents and capabilities of some of the leading companies in the private sector and some of the most successful nonprofits in civil society. So as a result of that effort and the commitment, we launched All for Good back in January, again, as a coalition of companies, nonprofits, working together to enable more Americans to serve. We did that by reaching out to Google, who really took a leadership role on this initiative and was fundamental to its success. And they came together along with Craig Newmark and his team from the Craigslist Foundation, as well as representatives from other companies who were involved, like Salesforce and Facebook and many others, who said, yes, let's use our resources as the leaders in the technology field. And they then collaborated with some of the leading players in the nonprofit space. Remarkable organizations like Volunteer Match, Idealist, Network for Good, who aggregate volunteer opportunities. And then, you know, folks like the United Way or the American Red Cross or Habitat for Humanity, many others who actually create opportunities on the ground in local communities. And then together with the talents of the high-tech community and the skills and capacities of the nonprofit community, we created All for Good. Now, what's important about All for Good is it is this open source website that is very transparent and accessible to anyone that allows Americans to search and share for service opportunities more effectively than ever before. And this has now serves All for Good as the back end, if you will, the search engine and the sharing engine for the administration's broad program on service, which this summer has been showcased in the United We Serve campaign. That is a campaign that's lasted the duration of the summer, that was initially announced by the president and the first lady, and has been showcased at events like the National Conference on Service and Volunteerism, where the First Lady gave the keynote in late June, and just last month at the All-Star Game, where the President threw out the first pitch and showcased a video with him and the other living presidents that was really focused on this idea that all Americans have the gifts, have the talents to contribute to strengthening their communities and helping to create a better country. And we can do that through service and volunteerism, being involved at a household level, in our communities, and on the causes we care about. So today, if you were to visit the website that the administration set up, it's www.serve.gov, and you were to search for service opportunities, you would be using All for Good. You can find our site at www.allforgood.org.
Jonathan, putting these opportunities on the website clearly moves us forward. So now you can make easy matches, right? So nonprofits can put opportunities on the website, on the web with little or no hassle. You've made it open source. But what are the other barriers to people actually doing it? Now that I've got the information, how do you get people to actually make the leap to sign up and do it?
That's really a great question, because many people are asking the same question, which is, I want to be involved. Now what? In fact, you know, I almost think the question of our time is now what? Because as you saw in the campaign, and as we see in our daily lives in so many ways, young people, older Americans, people in the midst of their careers, everyone is looking for ways to quote-unquote give back. It reminds me of the adage that someone once said to me, why should people wait till the end of their careers to give back? Does that mean they were taking away for the first half? And I think that's really true. So there are barriers which start with, number one, information. People are looking for ways to find opportunities that relate to their talents and skills. Now, what's exciting about All for Good is you can do a search in your geographic area on a keyword that you care about, say animals or education or health or homelessness or literacy, whatever the cause, and you can find opportunities in your area that are quote-unquote tagged. All for Good draws upon data feeds from, again, these leading nonprofits around the country. And in fact, I should point out, not just nonprofits. We're also bringing in opportunities from websites like Craigslist or Meetup, because the president has this vision that we agree that service isn't just cleaning the beach or painting a school, though that matters, but service must be accessible and inclusive and create the space for anyone of any socioeconomic status to be engaged. So a single mom who's working two jobs to make ends meet might not have an afternoon to spare a week. But you know what? There are ways that she can serve. And on allforgood.org, she can find those opportunities. So I think a big question is, number one, finding the opportunities. We've aggregated almost 250,000 listings at this point, making All for Good the largest aggregation of volunteer opportunities ever put together. And we're only able to do that, again, because of the remarkable help of these extraordinary nonprofit partners with whom we work. But number two, a second barrier is not just finding the opportunities, but it's making sure that volunteers have opportunities that they're excited about, and making sure that our wonderful nonprofits that need so much help are managing their volunteers effectively. So on allforgood.org, we're allowing our users, for example, to share opportunities, to, if you will, rate or like opportunities. These ratings capabilities and feedback loops are extremely important, because nonprofits who already do so much good work can benefit from hearing directly from the volunteers who contribute their time about ways that they can improve the experience for those volunteers. So I think All for Good is trying to solve two of the big questions in volunteering. Number one, how do we more effectively connect people to opportunities? And opportunities that really matter to them. On All for Good, you can log in with Facebook, or you can log in through Yahoo or AOL or Google. And again, you can find opportunities that match your skills and your interests. So finding opportunities is one problem we're trying to solve. And secondly, creating feedback loops to improve the volunteer experience is another issue that we're trying to address.
Jonathan, you are a serial entrepreneur. You create businesses and new ventures about as quickly as anything I've seen. You did Ethos Water, Good Magazine. You've got all sorts of new ventures that you've been involved in. Why? What drives you to keep starting things?
I think that I have been fortunate to be involved in some more extraordinary organizations and to help start and scale some terrific ventures. And I think there are a couple things that motivate me. I mean, number one, since I graduated from college, I've always wanted to change the world. I've always had a desire to sort of make an impact and not necessarily felt that I was relegated to simply a career in one field or on one track. I mean, it's the reason why when I graduated, I ended up volunteering for the Clinton for President campaign, working as a waiter, actually, in Harvard Square to subsidize my desire to be a part of what I thought would be, back in 1992, a world-changing campaign. And it was the reason why I was then lucky to spend a few years in Washington at the White House and the Commerce Department changing the world. And if you flash forward, these other enterprises like Ethos Water, which I co-founded with a friend. I didn't do it alone, for sure. He initially had the idea, a business school buddy, and together we were able to take his idea and his plan and scale it into a full-fledged enterprise. And a company that today is driving millions of dollars to bring clean water to children in need around the world and is educating people through our presence in Starbucks coffee stores all over the United States about the world water crisis, because it really is about education. And in terms of Good Magazine, I was fortunate to get recruited to be a part of that company. It had already started when I got there, but I was able to help focus a young management team, provide some leadership to broaden our vision beyond a publishing company to really being a diversified media play and a lifestyle brand around the idea of doing well and doing good. And again, in that case, I was fortunate to work with a fantastic team of founders who put the idea together and a young group that really had some initial traction. And even here with All for Good, I initially may have had an idea, but it only worked because of the fantastic people with whom I was able to collaborate. So you know what? If you take a desire to change the world and you throw some great people in the mix, amazing things can happen.
When you say, I wanted to change the world, what does that really mean? I mean, how do you know when you've done it? What does success look like for you?
You know, it's funny. I don't think there's a blueprint. I don't think there's a playbook that you can pull out of off the shelf and say, okay, I want to run this play today. I think it's different for every person. And this actually brings back to, I think, what's really magical about All for Good and what's so special about this president's vision of service is it doesn't fit into an orthodox notion of one must, for example, tutor children in the inner city, though I've done that and I think it's incredibly meaningful and important. Instead, I think everyone has an innate capacity for an impact. An impact can be realized through different ways. The application of your talents in the business world or your communication skills, everyone can do it in their own way. For me, what I found is I think my energy and my passion and some of my other talents have been best applied on early stage ventures and then taking maybe more mature enterprises and helping to scale them and set them up for long-term success. So how does one change the world? I think one changes the world by being in touch with one what a person finds important and then channeling your energies, your gifts, and again, your passion toward realizing those goals and achieving those dreams.
It's interesting. You led the effort to design a worldwide prize to break the cycle of global poverty for the XPRIZE Foundation. And I think the XPRIZE is quite interesting because you don't win the prize unless you solve the problem. So I'm really curious, breaking the cycle of global poverty, what were the criteria for the prize? In other words, how would you know if a winner had, in fact, broken the cycle of global poverty?
I'm really excited that you brought it up because the XPRIZE Foundation is a fantastic and really a world-class organization that has really helped to pioneer the idea of prize philanthropy. Started over 10 years ago by an amazing social entrepreneur named Peter Diamandis. And what he has done is simply amazing because in a way, by setting up these prizes, and these are prizes, large-scale prizes that are designed to tackle some of the toughest problems facing humanity, whether it's climate change, lunar exploration, more efficient transportation, or in this case, alleviating global poverty. What's exciting, though, as well, is that by setting out a prize and by tapping the entrepreneurial spirit of innovation, you are able to motivate not just one person in the way that I suppose happens in the lab model, per se, where someone is doing R&D. In fact, in this case, through prize philanthropy, you can inspire dozens and dozens and dozens of social entrepreneurs and innovators to develop different approaches and new models, all focused on one goal. So in this case, we set out to develop a prize to alleviate global poverty, and we thought about what are the different factors, if you will, that go into addressing such a massive problem. We consulted with the experts, which is, again, just simply XPRIZE methodology. They really are world-class at designing prizes and then executing them. So we engaged with some of the leading thinkers and pioneers in this issue of global development and social enterprise. We set out to create clear rules, transparent and simple, around one issue. And we developed several ideas, several concepts. As it's happened, we've raised a little bit of money from some different philanthropists, and they're working now to put a prize together in service of that ambition. But whether it ends up tackling the world water crisis or addressing the need for off-the-grid energy solutions in the developing world, or perhaps even thinking about how does one create sustainable, scalable microenterprise, jobs that work for people in the developing world. There is just a rich set of opportunities that the XPRIZE model, when applied, can really drive just breakthrough results.
But when you talk about breaking the cycle of global poverty, again, that doesn't sound incremental in any way. That sounds like something that has to scale and scale big. So is that what you're going to be looking for, and that will be the criteria against which you judge entries?
Yeah, I mean, you start with a big, bold, audacious goal like breaking the cycle of poverty. You need to then make sure that goal can be broken down into some component parts. And the XPRIZE Foundation is working through that rule development right now. We developed some initial ideas, and they're further refining those to take up my design and to get ready to launch it. So you need a prize to work, to be transparent and easy to understand, set against an achievable goal, and one that will drive sustainable impacts. So in this case, it's not about, let's say, for example, to use the water construct that we were talking about a few minutes ago, it's not about how can I deliver the most water to people at a given point in time, but rather how can I create sustainable systems that will ensure long-term access to water, sanitation, and hygiene. So it's a much more holistic model as opposed to a snapshot approach.
Let me switch subjects or extend the conversation. You're also a member of the faculty at the Anderson Graduate School of Management at UCLA. You teach social entrepreneurship. I want to ask you a question. What really makes social entrepreneurship different from other nonprofits?
I think that's a great question. I mean, the term social entrepreneurship is still so new and nascent that it means different things to different people. For me, I think social entrepreneurship is about several things. Number one, it represents true entrepreneurship. And so entrepreneurship is not necessarily just opening a storefront. Entrepreneurship is trying to build a business or an enterprise that will really scale and drive big impacts through the delivery of the product or services, through the eventual exit of the company. But it is really about big change and big impact. So it's not necessarily being a sole proprietor. It's more along the lines of truly being an innovator. And so as we think about social entrepreneurship, I would say social entrepreneurship is in part the application of principles of innovation to create both social good and financial return. So what's important here is that, number one, principles of innovation. This isn't simply about building a better mousetrap. This is about saying, I want to break the status quo. I want to build new systems that, again, change the equilibrium. So it is seeking something big in terms of its impact. Number two, it's about driving social good. So there is a clear emphasis and priority given to creating societal benefit. Now, one can measure this different ways, but it must be explicit and embedded in the mission of the enterprise, that part of the way that it will judge success, that its progress will be measured, will be how it is delivering broader benefits, not just to the shareholder per se, or to the entrepreneur, as it were, but to the broader set of stakeholders who are touched by the enterprise. And then number three, financial return. Social entrepreneurship, I think when it's best, is about driving earned income and thinking about models that create long-term economic security for the enterprise, for the community, etc. Now, in some cases, you see remarkable social entrepreneurs like Wendy Kopp from Teach for America or John Wood from Room to Read, who are both doing remarkable work. Wendy, to change the way we think about education in this country, and John Wood to change the way we think about literacy at a global level.
But I would assume both of those entrepreneurs that you've mentioned, both fantastic people who've done great, great things, they still rely on contributions.
They do, but I'm glad you asked because there's an important distinction that I wanted to make. I think the social entrepreneur both, again, applies principles of innovation to change the status quo, is focused explicitly on bringing, you know, societal benefit and generating social good. But thirdly, as we think about financial return, it might be through specific earned income strategies. Ethos Water might be case in point in that regard. But it also can be about applying market-based models to the nonprofit space. So let me tell you, if you've ever been involved or had any exposure to these Teach for America recruits, these people are not like, and again, I should say, full disclosure, my wife has worked in the nonprofit field for many, 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 many years. But nonetheless, I would say that the models that Teach for America are replicating and seeking to emulate are Fortune 500 models of recruiting people and retaining people and creating feedback loops. And in the case of Room to Read, their annual reports resemble the kind of reporting you see from a Microsoft or a General Electric. So these entities might not be driving earned income per se, but are instead adopting market-based models and private sector style behaviors, which I think in large part can help to explain their success. So again, that social entrepreneur is an individual, that rare, rare breed, who, number one, applies principles of innovation, not just to create immediate term impact in their small vicinity, but rather to change the status quo, to create a new equilibrium. And number two, they're seeking to generate social good explicitly, fundamentally, as part of their mission. And number three, they're seeking financial return or economic security.
What would be success for you with All for Good?
Success for All for Good is easy and something that we can quantify. We want to make service ubiquitous on the web. We want to change the way people think about engaging in their communities so that it's not something you do after the fact, but it simply becomes part of people's daily lives. So as we think about success, to briefly answer, number one, the number of people who volunteer today in America is roughly 60 million people. I hope when we are done, that number of people engaged in service is more like 120 or 150 million people. And number two, we want All for Good. You can find it again at allforgood.org, but you can also find All for Good on the HuffingtonPost.com or at MTV.com, because lots of websites are taking All for Good and embedding it directly into their websites themselves. And that's how we'll really make this win. Not when we force our users to go to allforgood.org, but when they can find service wherever they are on the web, after they read a piece of published content, after they schedule a travel package, after they think about bringing together a meeting. We want to make volunteerism and service simply a part of everyone's daily life.
Jonathan, it was a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you so much for your time.
Jonathan Greenblatt is leading the project, allforgood.org. We have links to all of his work on our website, smartcityradio.com. Finally this week, a few words on the greenery from our City View's commentator, Walker Smith.
As I've been out running this spring, I've noticed that the neighborhoods I run through are greener and lusher than I remember in years past. Tree branches are swinging low under their weight. Creeping vines are spilling out over the tops of fences and garden walls. Sidewalks are crowded with bulging green plants at the edge of every front yard. My wife reminds me that it's been a wetter spring than normal, so the trees and flowers and vines and grass have come out in unusual abundance. It makes every afternoon feel a little sticky and damp, and gives you that sort of claustrophobic feel you get when you're in the middle of a profusion of vegetation dripping with the moisture from a recent rainstorm. As I've run this year, perhaps the one thing I've noticed most is the jasmine. It fills the air as I run down every street. Its sweet, sticky aroma brings back memories of the distinctly southern places in which I grew up. The walk home from elementary school that I used to make in Spartanburg, South Carolina, that took me down streets edged with the big gardens that always seemed to front big, stately, colonial-style houses in the South. or the stone paths that used to ring my grandmother's rambling farmhouse in Alabama that were always overflowing with greenery and filled with the smells of honeysuckle and lavender and lilac. Or the spring days on the North Campus lawns at UNC Chapel Hill that always seemed to be bursting forth with a glut of flowering plants and trees. It has been a year rich with the seasonal renaissance of spring, and it makes the world feel bountiful. I mention it because there haven't been too many places for us to turn to lately where riches are in abundance. The stock market has shown some signs of life, but it's still well below its peak. Home sales are picking up again, but only because prices have fallen so much. Jobs are still not being created in enough numbers to absorb all the people who've lost theirs as a result of this recession. And while the downturn seems to be bottoming out, the recovery is likely to be drawn out. So if we're looking around for riches right now, our bank accounts are not the place to look. Instead, just look around us. Spring is out in full force, and in my neighborhood at least, it is flourishing. It takes me back, but it also points me forward. It reminds me that we don't need a stock bubble or a housing bubble to enjoy the richness of life. It goes without saying, but sometimes it just needs to be said again. There is more to life, and most of the best of it is free. This recession has been painful, even devastating for many of us. I am not insensitive to that, and I worry for those struggling to cope. But I also know that as we look ahead, we need to plan for a future that does not expose us to these kinds of risk and hardships. We overreached, overspent, and overdid it. We got too caught up in our shopping and buying and too indifferent about everything else. But while our shopping and buying has had to taper off, everything else is showing up again in copious and ample profusion. In these ways, we are as rich as ever, and will always be so if we would only just look around and see. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is the president of Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He joins us from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. There's a lot more Smart City on our website, smartcityradio.com. You can read my blog, sign up for our weekly newsletter, or subscribe to the podcast. You can also get in touch with us by clicking on the contact button or by emailing us questions to questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundation's investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. I'm Carol Coletta.